A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues here on Share Radio. I'm Georgie Frost here every weekday from 9 until 1 with my producer Annie Weston on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. Now, this is the time where we welcome the team from This Is Money, the award-winning money section of The Mail Online, into the studios. Editor Simon Lambert and journalist Mark Shoffman are here today to talk through the top stories that they've been investigating this week, including, is paying for financial advice on your pension just paying for something you could do yourself? Editor Simon Lambert certainly doesn't think so. As inflation falls to 0%, is it time to consider cutting interest rates further? Are DIY ISAs a good idea? Should young people be allowed to dip into a pension for their home deposit? And how to deal with those pesky cold callers? Plus, we've only just gotten over Zayn Malik quitting One Direction. Couldn't carry on anymore, wasn't being true to himself, apparently. In another entertainment blow, Downton Abbey is to end after next series. The show regularly pulls in 11 million viewers in the UK, strong worldwide following. So in celebration of good TV, I want to know what is the best TV series / box set ever. Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Mark Shoffman.
Well, at the risk of causing a complete meltdown, I could mention my love of Midsummer Murders.
Don't do this to me,
but
Simon.
Actually, I think The Wire was my absolute favourite. The Wire or Breaking Bad, but I think probably The Wire. I absolutely loved The Wire, and I've just started rewatching it again and remembered quite how good that first series of The Wire was. So, that.
All I've got in my head is a warm bath of homicide now. Thank you so much for that. Do listen back to previous episodes if you don't know what on earth we're talking about. Mark Shoffman, you?
My favourite series was killed off well before its time. It was a US series called Flash Forward, which was on Channel 5. And the idea was that the whole world, everyone in the world, blacked out for, I think, 3 minutes or so and saw a glimpse of their future a few months ahead. And then they all wake up where they currently were. I mean, it's all about how they're getting to that stage and whether the stuff will just happen or whether they can change fate. And it was really exciting. It had Rupert Everett and a whole load of former Lost cast members.
My wife started watching some of it and we watched a bit of it, and I must admit that I kind of lost interest, to be perfectly honest.
Oh, that's the trouble. But
we're sort of split between the type of Wire ones and the sort of sci-fi ones, i.e. it's me and you, Mark, against everybody else that's got in contact, because mine are, and I've stolen three here, Battlestar Galactica, the new series, the miniseries V, the old one, do you remember that?
Yeah.
The best, Quantum Leap.
Quantum Leap, yeah, I remember that. I used to like that. But I tell you what, actually, there's one I do love that we watched from start to finish that I think is absolute comic gold, Frasier. One of the best things on TV. And, you know, I can't remember how many series there are. There's something ridiculous, like, I want to say 18, but that sounds like way too many, but it might even be that much.
Well, I'll ask Annie what other people have been saying and Google it while she does.
Michael agrees with you, Simon. The Wire, definitely. Ben says Sopranos, 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 which I totally agree with. Love the Sopranos. Charlotte has gone for the thick of it. Kat says Orange is the New Black, Scrubs, or don't judge me, Keeping Up with the Kardashians. Jimmy says West Wing. Gareth says The Wire as well. And Katie is currently looking at Twin Peaks.
Oh, like Twin Peaks. And yeah, I can tell you there were 11 series of Frasier. And that, Editor Simon Lambert, is why the Share Radio team beat the This Is Money team in the TSB pub quiz this week.
We're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
Should point out, though, that editor Simon Lambert, you were not there, nor journalist Mark Shoffman either, at this pub quiz, and it was only by half a point, and I do believe journalist Ed Monk has still not let it go.
And I should point out that Georgie just Googled the answer to that Frasier question.
That's fine. You know, I was going to say that. I was just double-checking that was correct. Anyway, I'm Georgie Frost. Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Mark Shoffman here in the studio with me. Coming up, at what point should you seek expert advice when it comes to personal on finance, particularly with regards to pensions. But first, I want to ask the team, because David Cameron and Ed Miliband made their opening election pitches in the first live TV contest of the campaign, what they made of the two performances. Our reporter Tom Hourigan rounds up the events.
The Prime Minister went first on the Sky News and Channel 4 show and was asked if he could live on a 0 hours contract.
No, I couldn't live on one of those.
He didn't know how many food banks there were.
I don't have the exact figures.
While Ed Miliband was asked if he was tough enough to be in number 10.
Hell yes, I'm tough enough.
And an audience member asked him why he was always gloomy.
Are things really so bad?
No, but they could be a lot better.
Those in the audience were divided.
I've supported Labour in the past, yeah.
I'm definitely not.
But one poll for The Guardian gave David Cameron the win. Just.
Now, lads, I want to know, as journalists, what you made of their performance. Mark, I believe you were very engaged in it.
Yeah, well, I think that they both politicians showed two ways that you can do an interview and two ways to answer questions. First of all, David Cameron, I think, came across quite condescending. Like, there's nothing worse than when you're talking to someone for a kind of news piece and every time you ask a question, they say, well, that's a good question. Because you sort of think, well, I know it's a good question, that's why I asked it. Yeah, that doesn't bring him across quite well. Whereas, in comparison, Ed Miliband, who is painted as this kind of meek, miserable wallflower, I think he came across really well. Like, he stood up to Paxman, he came up with kind of great phrases like, hell yeah. He was asked about people seeing him as kind of this middle class person who can't relate to society, and he just turned around to Paxman and said, who cares? Who cares? Like, for a politician to actually come across and talk like as a real person, like as a human being, rather than saying, oh, that's a good question, I think that's reassuring for a voter.
It's easier, though, when you are in opposition, though, isn't it? It sort of had a touch of Nick Clegg last year about it, didn't it?
Well, yeah, that was what I was going to say. So I can't judge their performances because I didn't read this, so I'm not going to be one of those people who judges a book without actually reading the book. But I've heard the reaction this morning, and I think that what is interesting is that that Miliband appears to have potentially come over slightly better than Cameron on this, which is surprising because actually I would have said this whole argument about the TV debates. I'd be surprised if David Cameron was running scared from the TV debates because, to be honest, if you look at the other political parties, the only person who I'd be worried about if I was him would be Nigel Farage. Mm. Because the others, I think David Cameron is a much smoother operator with a much better set of answers. And people, I do think, actually, despite all these complaints about posh, too much money, all that kind of stuff, connect better with him than they do, for example, with Miliband. But, you know, Miliband seems to have done well here, and he's got a lot of ground to make up there because, like you say, a lot of that stuff with the Lib Dems last time round was off the back of those TV debates and Nick Clegg doing really well in them.
Well, I'll be sticking with editor Simon Lambert's opinion as we turn our attention to at which point should you seek out expert advice when it comes to personal finance? Even if you consider yourself financially pretty informed, can it be a good thing to call in the experts from time to time to give you a hand? We're particularly talking about this in regard to pensions. Now, you've written an article. What have you been saying, Simon? You're quite opinionated on this.
Well, I said that I thought people should actually pay for financial advice with their pensions. We've got this big pension freedom change coming up where people are going to be given access to their pension pot. And I think that this is an instance where actually people should be taking financial advice. It almost pained me to publish it, to be perfectly honest. So I've always been very reluctant to pay for something that I think I could do myself. And if I'm going to be entirely honest, financial advice has always fallen slightly into that bracket of thinking, well, am I really getting value for money? And it's always, there's been this promotion of the value of advice. You can get more out of it than it costs you. And maybe if you'd have said to me a year ago with the sort of the pension thing, I would have looked at it quite simply in the way that many of our readers actually in the comments have looked at it and said, well, look, you give me my pension pot. I am more than capable of building a simple, low-cost investment portfolio that will provide me with an income. I can spend a bit of the capital from it. I don't need to pay someone thousands of pounds to do that for me. There's a wealth of resources online that can help me. You know, things like This Is Money, things like the DIY investing platforms. But actually, from speaking to advisors, speaking to experts, speaking to professionals in the industry over the last few months, I've thought a lot more about this. And there's a lot of things that they bring up that I just don't think that most people, even if they were very well financially informed, would necessarily think about. And actually, it's probably more important for people with small pension pots than it is for big pension pots, because a small pension pot is a lot. You need to try and get much more income out of it proportionally to really make a difference to your lifestyle, and B, it's a lot easier to spend it very quickly.
You said they bring things up. Like what?
OK, so, I mean, firstly, a lot of this surrounds basically people not wanting to take out annuities anymore with their pension pot. And these are people with defined contribution pension pots, not people with final salary pots, where paying them their retirement income is the responsibility of their employer. And an annuity is a product that gives you an income for the rest of your life. But they've been considered very poor value, very opaque. It's very difficult to see what you're getting out of it. And you buy that annuity and you bought it, it gives you an income. Once you die, it's gone. Now people are going to be given their pension pot. And a lot of people, there's been a massive drop in the sale of annuities, about 2/3. So people aren't buying annuities. But there's an important thing here where advisors are saying, well, you need to go through your old pension plan contracts because you might have a guaranteed annuity rate in there, which might say that it would pay you a rate of, say, 12% a year. Now, at the moment, you'd be lucky to get 6. And people doing this themselves might just not realise that. There's also this suggestion that you could just take your money out of your pension and you'll pay something called your marginal rate of tax. Now, most people don't realise that what will happen is the money you take out of your pension will be added to your income for that year, and that will then set what your income level is, and you'll pay the tax on it. So someone taking all of their money out of, say, a £100,000 pension pot could find themselves paying 45% tax on quite a lot of it. Also, there's this suggestion that basically you could potentially defer your state pension by a couple of years, spend some of your pension income instead of that, and then 3 years down the line, you would have substantially boosted your income by a level that you would very much struggle to do just by using your pension pot. And these are all quite complicated things for people to get their heads around. And A, they need them to be suggested to them, and B, they need someone to explain them and to think through them. And I think that this is a situation where there's a real value in financial advice. Say, for example, you've got a £30,000 pension pot. That's not going to buy you a huge retirement income. And if you take £1,500 out of it to pay for financial advice, that's a big chunk out of your pot. So there it starts to be like, well, should you just go down an online route? But that online route's not going to bring up those things that we were just talking about, those questions that might be answered. And I mean, and some advisors have said to me, well, look, if you were in the old days, if you were going to buy an annuity with your pension pot, loaded into that was a sort of commission-style cost. And it might have cost you £1,500 loaded into that. You just didn't see that £1,500. So speak to an advisor, ask them, because you don't actually have to necessarily start paying them from the off. What a lot will do is they'll do a free review with you and tell you how much it would cost for the advice, what kind of thing you could expect from it, and then after that, if you say yes, you then go see them and you're on the clock and you start paying. So speak to a couple of advisors, say, could you get me more value than I would have to pay you? Lay this all out for me. And if you're happy that, what they're suggesting sounds good and the price sounds good, then maybe you should go with it. But I think my point is that it's worth thinking about. It's the thinking about it bit that's the important bit.
You said that you could spend about £1,500. Is that average?
Well, we've got some costs, actually, that Mark's got here in front of him, sort of some rough costs for various things.
Yes, so the advisor website unbiased.co.uk does a regular value of advice survey that looks at the cost of certain advice. So for retirement advice on a £100,000 pot, it surveyed some of its advisors and found that would cost a client £2,000. For a £200,000 pot, that costs £3,000.
£3,000.
Sorry, £3,000. But it's not just that outright cost you've got to think about. It's also the amount of value you're actually adding to your retirement income. So the unbiased report works out that using an advisor when planning your retirement can give you an additional income of £3,654 each year.
I question that figure, but there's certainly a suggestion that if you, say, for example, you spent £1,500, you could end up getting £1,500 extra income every year for the rest of your life.
What I do like about the article, because I was reading it thinking, who have you been paid by to write this article, Simon? Apart from your obviously normal job, but the caveat you say at the end is that advisors and pension firms have to make sure that their customers get the service they deserve for the price they pay, something they've not had a glittering record on in the past.
Absolutely. And so I said it almost pained me to write this. So I've spent an awful long time reading readers' complaints. Pained me.
I thought you were paying for
the start. No, it didn't pay me. I mean, work paid me, obviously.
No, it pained you.
It pained me to write this, in that I've spent an awful lot of time reading complaints from people who have had bad advice, or they've been missold products, or just advisors just haven't really done a great deal for them. But then I also speak to a lot of good financial advisors who have a lot of important and interesting things to say that people would not necessarily think about. And the world of financial advice has changed, and I think people looking at, especially at their pensions here, need to realise that this is a decision that will affect them for the rest of their life. It will affect their retirement income. It's going to affect how, you know, ultimately how happy they are in retirement. You could very easily run down a pension pot nowadays with the new freedoms that come in. And that, you know, advisors don't get that commission anymore. There were changes made so that you have to pay them this fee up front and they don't get paid through commission. So there's much less incentive for them to mis-sell you a product just because it pays them a chunky commission. And that also, you know, the world of financial advice has changed, and that they should maybe just look into it. I mean, there's some interesting comments here, you know, from people who basically say, well, someone said, I assume this is a paid advertisement for pension advisors.
Georgie commenting on the story.
But, you know, I think someone said, I used to be one of those experts, and in my experience, 1 in 20 people get it right. At some stage, they'll balls up, which will leave them to fester, and it will cost them thousands. And so this is someone who was an advisor saying that actually one of the best things that advisors do is they protect you from your own mistakes. They stop you doing something stupid. Actually, there was a very good article written about that by Louise Cooper, who's a City commentator recently. I'd advise people to Google it. Maybe I'll pull it out and stick it up on the web, try and link to it on the website somewhere. But she said that very same thing, that basically the reason for financial advice is to stop yourself doing something stupid.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues. I'm Georgie Frost. Now, the rise of do-it-yourself investing has revolutionised how people manage their ISAs. Armed with, or perhaps just a smartphone, maybe a laptop, people can now use a DIY investing platform to make the most of their money. But with so many available, how on earth do you decide which one to use? Well, thankfully, Simon, I believe you've written about this and can tell us. DIY investment platforms, what are we talking about here?
We're talking about places online where you can go and invest your own money to buy shares, funds, investment trusts. You can manage it all in one place. You can simply log on, buy and sell shares or funds, see how your holdings are doing. And in many instances, there'll be guides, useful advice, perhaps model portfolios of things that you can invest in, and all kinds of tools that can help you out. And this has been a massive growth area in recent years. There's some big names that have been around for quite a long time. And there's some new players who've come into the market. And there's been an explosion of them. It seems like there's barely a week that goes by, actually, without a new one telling us that they've launched.
Why is that? Why has there been an explosion?
Because a couple of years ago, basically, they changed the rules surrounding financial advice, which is what we were just talking about. Mm-hmm. And basically, many people before would probably have invested through a financial advisor, and a financial advisor would have sold them an investment fund, and then they would have put them into somewhere where it was then managed, and the advisor would have got paid a commission out the back of that every year that person remained invested. And they cut that, and now basically people have to pay financial advisors an upfront fee. So there was obviously a big opportunity for people to come in and say, well, if you don't want to pay a financial advisor £1,000, you could just pay us a small amount every year and you can manage your money online. And also, it's just the growth of the internet. The world has changed. This is so much easier now than it would have been, for example, 10 years ago. So people have taken this to heart, and, you know, if you're just going to pick your own funds, pick your own shares and do that kind of thing, you maybe don't need a professional to do it. You can do your own research.
Wow, from one extreme to the other. So pensions, yes.
Well, yeah.
ISA investing, no.
Well, if you're not comfortable making decisions about investing yourself, then, and you don't want to do the research and you don't want to do the work, then maybe you should speak to an advisor, or maybe you should just buy a very cheap tracker fund, which, you know, does all the work for you. But in terms of the platforms, it's not just about what you invest in, it's about how you invest. And you need to think about the best platform for you, because they all charge in different ways. And there is a bewildering array of charges out there.
Give us an idea of some of those charges that you're likely to see.
Well, we first drew up our roundup to the best DIY investing platforms about 2.5 years ago. And over that time, charges have changed, but there's still a real sort of array of things you need to think about. So firstly, there's how much is it going to cost you to use that platform every year? And there's an admin fee. And that will either be a percentage of the money that you have invested, or it will be a flat fee. And if you've only got a small amount of money invested, then the percentage will cost you less because it's a percentage of a small amount. If you've got a large amount of money, then you might be better off paying a flat fee because it will represent a lower amount of the money that you've got invested. You've then got whether you pay to buy or sell investment funds. On some platforms, mainly those that charge a percentage fee, you can get free fund dealing. And on other platforms, mainly those that charge a flat fee, you have to pay perhaps £10 each time you want to buy or sell. Then there is the cost of share dealing, which you will always have to pay for, but can range between, say, £5 and £15. And then there's other things like the cost of regular investing or reinvesting dividends and things like that. So you need to think about, what am I going to do and how am I going to be investing and where am I now and where am I going to be going, and then work out what platform best suits you. And the reason why that's important is because, to be perfectly honest, once most people sign up with one of these things, they very rarely move.
It's quite complicated.
It is
just
complicated.
Listening to you talk there.
And that is why we have this roundup where we try and explain all of this and lay it out. I mean, Mark does a lot of stuff on the new platforms that are launching, and there is just this bewildering array of charges.
Yeah, there's a lot of charges, and it's not just the price you're paying, but it's also what you're getting for that price on top of the access to the funds and stuff. There's kind of research and guidance and tools and calculators you can use to kind of see how much you could earn and work out taxes and things like that. But when I look at it, it's to me, it's sort of like buying a car, and you could have a kind of dull Ford Mondeo just to get you from A to B and save a certain amount, or you could get like a Lamborghini with kind of sat nav and, I don't know, lots of tools and videos for a more kind of hands-on approach, I guess.
On This Is Money, you spoke to expert Holly Mackay, a view of the top 10 platforms that she's road tested as to where you should invest your ISA. She actually spoke to Share Radio.
I think what we've seen of late is actually more people start to look to stocks and shares, ISAs, as they look at the frankly dismal rates available in cash ISAs. And I think in a cash ISA today, if you're doing well, of course, and you've shopped around, if you've stayed with your bank, you're probably being treated really badly. But if you've shopped around, you might be getting between 1 and 1.5%. We now have about a 50-50 split in the UK between cash ISAs and stocks and shares ISAs. And I think, you know, even the announcement about savings and not having interest applied on the first £1,000, I think sort of the end of this tax year, what we're going to continue to see is more people putting a toe in the stocks and shares market because of the dismal rates they're getting in cash.
More people putting a toe in the stocks and shares market. Very interesting. The reason that we're talking about this, of course, a short window left to use this year's £15,000 ISA allowance. But what did you make there, Simon, of what Holly was saying and what she's written on your website?
Well, I think the stuff that Holly's done around this is really good. And what she's written is because she's road tested a lot of these platforms. I mean, I've road tested quite a few of them, but it's very difficult to road test all of them. And fair play to Holly. She's done that with the top 10. But in order to help people out, I think probably it would be helpful if I explained a little bit about what it could look like for different people. So say, for example, you're a new investor who's only just starting out and you're going to be regularly investing, maybe into investment funds, which is one of the easiest ways to invest. Then you want to probably be looking for a platform that charges you a percentage fee and doesn't charge you for buying or selling funds. So some that do that are Hargreaves Lansdown, Fidelity, a smaller platform called Rplan, which has got lots of helpful tools, and Best Invest. If you've got a bit more money and you're moving further up the scale and you don't mind paying to buy and sell funds, then you can start looking at ones that charge you a flat fee. So perhaps you might want to go for something like the Share Centre, Alliance Trust, or Interactive Investor. And what's good about Interactive Investor is they'll charge you £20 a quarter, but they then give you that back in free trades. So you could actually get most of that admin charge back. Or you might want to look at something where if you're buying shares, you want to keep that share dealing down to the lowest possible charge. So if you're buying shares regularly, you don't really want to be necessarily paying £10 to £15 to do so. So look for something like perhaps AJ Bell Uinvest, which has cheaper share dealing, iWeb, which has £5 share dealing. And there's one called Club Finance, actually, which charges an admin fee of 0.24%, which sounds quite low, but it charges a minimum of £120 a year. But you then get £2.50 share dealing. So if you want to build up a portfolio of, say, 20 shares, the difference between paying £2.50 for doing that and paying £12.50 for doing that is quite a lot. So it's, as I said, it's thinking about what sort of bracket you fit into. And then there are other platforms that will do quite a bit of the work for you. There's one called Nutmeg where you put in your goals and it has a special tool that works out for you. And they actually, it's like wealth management, they actually choose where to invest for you. And then many of these platforms as well will also have sort of model portfolios or selections of funds. So if you're not happy with choosing your investments yourself, say choosing your funds yourself, then you could go and they'll have a selection of 10 funds that balances you across different areas and you can just automatically put your money into those and then you don't need to worry about it. If you're someone who's been investing for quite a long time and has quite a large pot, then you probably want to be thinking more about the sort of flat fee element, and you're probably the kind of person who's more happy picking your own investments. So in that instance, probably go for the flat fee. So that's a sort of rough guide, basically.
Do you agree with Holly, though? Do you think more of us are going to get involved in this area?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I think so. We're seeing more people doing it all the time. I think there is still a problem where people are reluctant to invest money that they probably should be investing. So they might have a large amount of cash savings and they keep it all in cash. Or they could potentially be just regularly investing maybe £50 a month or something just to start off, because it is the best way to grow your wealth over time. You know, the stock markets rise, you diversify, you balance your investments, and you will beat cash. You will do much better than leaving your money left sat in a savings account.
Well, I know, Mark, you've written about cash ISAs, certainly, and you've questioned whether budget changes could be the death of the cash ISA, as it were.
Yes.
Explain more about that.
Well, this is the change that the Chancellor announced in the budget, where you wouldn't be taxed on the first £1,000 of interest on a savings account. So to earn £1,000 on a cash ISA, you'd need, I think the best cash ISA rate is 1.65 or something. And we worked out you'd need, I think, a lot of money in that account to earn.
It's over 70,000.
Yeah,
something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly, yeah. Not many people have that much in a cash ISA. So if you're just going to get £1,000 tax-free through your savings anyway, the question is, what is the point in putting it in an ISA where you're probably going to have to lock it up for a certain period of time, ultimately a year, or if you want to get the best rates, probably 3 or 5 years. So instead, you could have it in a savings account where you can access it when you want and you're getting £1,000 of interest each year tax-free. But on the flip side of that, ISAs do have their benefits. You can pass on your ISA to your spouse after death without inheritance tax. Ultimately, the government aren't really likely to tinker with ISAs, so you're always going to have that tax-free wrapper, but there's always a risk that they could tinker with savings accounts and change the rates, and you don't really know what the best, like, savings rates could fall, particularly as inflation is so low.
Which we will be talking about in a very short time, teeing us up nicely there, Mark. But just to say, there's a couple more articles on your website. Virgin revamping two of its fixed rate ISA deals, pushing them to the top of the Best Buy saving tables. And also, savers who opened a cash ISA in the run-up to the end of last tax year need to check the rate now, as once top deal could be practically worthless.
Yeah, you should. It's definitely, it's the time of year everybody's minds are sharpened towards ISAs, because the tax deadline runs around, the ISA deadline runs around, and nobody likes to do things a year in advance, so they all do it at the last minute, don't they? I mean, realistically, if you've got money to put in an ISA, you should have put it in there last April, not now. But the reality of how people's lives work, including my own, I should say, mm-hmm. is that, we've got like a couple of weeks left, I need to do something. But yeah, if you've got ISAs, this is a good time to sit down and go, right, could they be in a better place? Because there's not just new money that you're putting into the best rates, it's old ISAs. They might have fallen onto a really rubbish rate now. And let's face it, banks and building societies are not doing savers any favours at the moment. They complain about low interest rate environments, but they're making plenty of money. So move your money, move it to the best ISA that you possibly can. And it is worth having an ISA because, like Mark said, we've got £1,000 savings interest tax-free now. It's only £500 if you're a higher rate taxpayer. But someone could change that at the drop of a hat, whereas the fundamental principle of ISAs is that your interest is tax-free. So unless someone's going to completely rip up the entire ISA system, you can probably work on the basis that that will continue. And actually, if interest rates go up, then you'll find that £70,000 to get your £1,000 of interest suddenly starts coming down, and it might only be £30,000 or £20,000.
Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Mark Shoffman from This Is Money. Coming up, as Mark said there, as inflation falls to 0%, is it time to consider cutting interest rates further?
Morning Money. The markets, the papers and the city. Today's Need to Know on Share Radio.
Every morning from 6 to 9, tune in to Morning Money on Share Radio.
With Sandra Kilhoff and Mark Johnson.
An in-depth look at the UK and global markets and business.
Giving you all the day's need to know.
Morning Money.
Getting you ready for the day ahead.
Welcome back to Consuming Issues. I'm Georgie Frost, editor Simon Lambert, journalist Mark Shoffman from This Is Money in the studio with me now. Now, the UK inflation rate fell to 0% in February, the lowest since records began, a fall from 0.3% the month before, thanks to falling food and oil prices, supermarket price wars, they say. So, happy news for household budgets. These people say they're feeling the benefit.
Well, fuel's gone down about 109 now. 109 used to be about £1.30 a litre.
Well, we've just been shopping and noticed a few things have come down, well, with the sales.
No, it's been all right, you see. It's not that bad.
I can't say as I've noticed anything particularly going down.
So, well, this question of inflation's fallen to zero, which, if you were to listen to the Bank of England and the Chancellor, they would tell you that low inflation and deflation is what they're planning for all along. This is fantastic news. Never mind that 300-odd billion that we spent on quantitative easing and everything to avoid deflation and low inflation.
It was all part of the grand master plan. You know that, Simon.
All part of the plan. I know. No, I mean, we've got this. Is this a problem? Should we cut interest rates rather than raise them? Or should we keep them low for a really long time? Now, we asked the question on the website, when should the Bank of England raise interest rates? One of the answers wasn't, should it cut them, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
But the answers were now, which I was tempted to write in capital letters, in the next 6 months, in a year's time, much further down the line. Now, what's really interesting about the results that we've got off the back of this, and bearing in mind there's nearly 2,000 people have voted here, is that 42% of people said now.
Wow.
Yeah, but 36% of people said much further down the line. Right, which leaves only 11% saying in the next 6 months and only 12% saying in a year's time. So the vast majority of the split is basically between now and a long, long way in the future. And if you were to introduce the idea of should we cut interest rates, it would be fairly safe to say that if you were to say to some of these people, should we cut interest rates, the now brigade would say, God, no. And the much further down the line would give us an Ed Miliband-style, hell yeah.
We're on the same wavelength with that one. It sounds like they're part of the Monetary Policy Committee because they're all split on this, aren't they? David Miles, I think, is warning against a knee-jerk reaction, which dismissed suggestion from Andy Haldane, who's the bank's chief economist, that rates should be cut. Mark Carney says it'd be extremely foolish to cut rates. Mark, your views?
Yeah, well, they've been going on about this for ages, like for the last, I don't know, 2 years or so, every time there's an interest rate decision or inflation report, they're saying we're sticking to this 2% target. The economy is going to do all right. It will recover itself. We'll be okay in the long run. But yeah, now we have this deflation issue. Yet they don't seem to be kind of taking any action. They're kind of sitting there, I don't know, rubbing their hands, saying this is what we planned for. It's all part of a plan.
Is there consensus as to, so inflation is up, deflation down. Where is zero? What are we calling that? Flation?
No-flation? Flatflation. Didn't Ed Bowsher on here call it flatflation, I think?
Personal finance expert Ed Bowsher coining terms, flatflation. You've heard it here first.
No-flation? No.
Answers on a postcard, let us know. That's your next poll, Simon. What should it be called? But should we be celebrating? Should we be worried? Short term, I know you always think it's not a bad thing.
I don't think it's a bad thing. I think putting a bit more money in people's pockets is a good thing. I think if you ask people over the last 5 years, what's been your biggest concern, those who've got money in fact, even those who've got money and not got money, those who've got money have said, I get no return on my savings rates and my bills keep going up. Those who don't have any money don't complain about having no returns on their savings, but do say, my bills keep going up. And this has been the thing that's held back the economy, is everybody's bills have been going up and their wages haven't been going up too. And at the moment, we're now seeing wages which are rising above the cost of living, not because wages have risen much, but because the cost of living has fallen. And we're seeing people getting a real return on their savings rates. So I don't think a period of that is particularly bad news. There is this concern that if it gets baked in, what will happen is companies will stop offering people pay rises because they'll go, well, your cost of living isn't going up, so we won't offer you a pay rise. But I'm not so sure that in a reasonably buoyant economy that's going to happen. I think there's starting to be a bit more competition for employees out there, a bit more competition, you know, coming up to give people jobs, and I'm not certain that that will happen. But the one thing that I would add is that we've got a comment here from someone who says, I would love some deflation, but sadly, I think this is just the tide going out before the tsunami of hyperinflation descends upon us.
Cheery bunch, your readers, aren't they, Simon?
Absolutely cheery bunch, our readers. But what's interesting is basically, look at the price of petrol. A couple of months back, we were talking about how much petrol had fallen. Is it going to go down to below £1 a litre? Petrol is up massively over the past month or so. I think I drove past the petrol station last night and it was 113, 114. Mm. I mean, that's, you're looking at maybe 10p more than it was a month and a half ago. Once, if that continues and the oil price goes back up and that petrol price increase comes back in a year's time, there's going to be a lot more inflation in those figures. And also, potentially, obviously, depending on who gets elected and whether this crazy price freeze is brought in for energy companies, you could see energy companies raise prices in a year's time. So actually, those inflation figures in a year's time might look very, very different to how they do now.
Well, look into your crystal ball. What do you think they're going to look like?
I don't know. You can't predict things like that.
You're not a politician. Yeah,
so I think that maybe the oil price will probably... I think the oil price will probably rise and it will stabilise maybe about $70. I think maybe energy costs are going to go up a bit, and I think that it will put a bit more inflation back into it, and you're probably going to be seeing inflation closer to 2% in a year's time than you will see it closer to zero.
What will all this mean for our debts and borrowing at the moment?
Well, theoretically, if you've got debts, deflation or low inflation is bad news because it means that your debts are rising in real terms. But actually, you don't pay your debts with the cost of living, do you? You pay your debts with your wages. So what matters is your wages. So if your wages are rising, it's your wages rising versus the cost of your debts that matters. And at the moment, wages are picking up a little bit. And in terms of savings, well, people are finally beating inflation.
Mark, you're laughing along there.
Well, I think obviously we do our savings tables on This Is Money. And yeah, if inflation is zero, then every savings deal is beating the cost of living. But that doesn't mean that savings deals are that good. I think the best rate was now Virgin's at 1.65 and or a five-year one for 2 point something, I think.
But isn't it worth pointing out that the CPI measure, though, of inflation, it doesn't include housing costs?
No, it doesn't include housing costs. So, and there's been a very strong argument that they should be put into there because, I mean, it's very difficult to look at the cost of living and remove the bit where you have to put a roof over your head, isn't it? As much as it'd be nice to go live outside in the park, we don't really have the climate for it. So should it have that cost of servicing a mortgage put into there? But then also, it's not just because it's the cost of doing so, but it's measuring the change in the cost of doing so. And so the argument against having it in there is that can shift around a lot. And what you're doing is you're using interest rates to control inflation. But then if you put interest rates up to control inflation, the act of putting interest rates up means that the cost of servicing those mortgages goes up, and then it feeds straight into the inflation numbers. That's one of the reasons behind it. But I would argue there's a very strong reason for putting the cost of a house into the cost of living.
I would also agree the same thing. Talking of housing, young people say they want to save into a pension, but as long as they can dip into it to buy their first home. Good idea?
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
And I'm Georgie Frost, and this is Consuming Issues here with you every weekday from 9 until 1 with my producer Annie Weston on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. Now, young people say they would be more likely to save into a pension if they were allowed to dip into that pot for a deposit on a first home. That's according to a new survey from Now Pensions. They say that some 58% of 18 to 35-year-olds aren't saving anything for retirement, but just over 50% say they would either start saving or save a little bit more if they could also use that money to get on the property ladder. Well, this week we've been speaking to young people about their attitudes towards pensions. 17-year-old Liberty, I think she's too young to be saving.
I think it's a good thing to start saving like as early as possible. I'm definitely a save, not a spend kind of person, because it means that when you're older, your quality of life does improve. But I don't think there's a... I wouldn't see myself starting to save into a pension anytime soon. Like, I'm not even 18 yet. I think that would be... I can't imagine myself doing that. I think it would be a bit excessive.
That's 17-year-old Liberty. What about 25-year-old Lucy? She says she'd love to save for her pension, simply can't afford to.
I'm 25 and I work in the NHS. I've decided to opt out of my pension scheme, even though I know like it's supposed to be a good one, because I can't really afford to pay it at the moment. So it comes out at about £150 a month, which I just don't have spare. But I do think it's a good idea and I will opt in when I can afford it.
Listening to Lucy there, Simon, you were shaking your head.
Well, we talked about this the last time I was here, a couple of weeks back, and I was saying that I think people need to start saving as early as possible for a pension and realise quite how much extra benefit saving early will do. And those NHS pensions are really good pensions. You know, they're not as good as they used to be, but they're a lot better than the defined contribution pensions that most of us who work in the private sector get. And, yeah, that £150 is probably a big chunk of her earnings, and I'm not going to say that she should or shouldn't be doing anything, but putting that £150 in will really pay off in the long term, and it's a really good idea to find that money.
But doesn't that say to you the situation that a lot of young people face?
Yeah, it does.
And they can't afford £150. I was in exactly the same position at around the same age as her as a journalist.
Absolutely.
There's no way I could have done it.
Oh, absolutely. When I started off as a journalist, I didn't pay any money into my pension either, on my local newspaper salary of 12 grand a year. Mm-hmm. But you know what? And actually, so the point is, right, so she's had that set number because it's a defined benefit pension scheme, so there's a set number there. But actually most people won't be in defined benefit schemes anymore. They'll be in defined contribution schemes and they can set the number. So they'd be able to say, well, I can't afford 150, but I could afford 50. And I think even when I was on that 12 grand a year and I was running out of money every month, I think I probably could have found the 50 quid. And if I had have found that 50 quid... would have made quite a bit of difference by now. So, I don't know, that's just people need to think about that. But this story about should people be able to dip into their pension pots, basically, to buy a home? Should young people be able to do that? This has triggered quite a lot of debate back at This Is Money Towers. And
share with us. What have you guys been talking about?
Well, so my first reaction to this is a very un-Ed Miliband-like, hell no! It's like, this is your retirement fund. Mm. This is for your retirement. Your pension is for your retirement. So, no, don't spend it on other things because you need it in retirement. If you spend it on other things, you'll retire one day and you go, oh, where's my pension? Oh, I spent it. So you'd be left on your own, just on the state pension. But then also, there's this thing of like, well, if that is the genuine difference between you being able to afford to buy a house or not, well, the one of the great advantages of a house is it's a lifetime investment, mm-hmm. because at the end of that, you can live in it for free once you've paid the mortgage off. So if you're going to retire and you don't have to pay rent, then that's a big difference to your lifestyle. And so say it's going to cost you £1,000 a month to rent a home, right? Well, the difference between having bought that home and not bought that home is going to be £12,000 a year. You'd need a pretty big pension pot to get yourself an income of £12,000 a year. So then it makes me think, well, maybe people should be able to do this. But I don't know, maybe... I just worry it's a slippery slope. And we were talking about this on the way over here.
Well, I think this whole thing... pensions need to be seen as the tool you're using to save for your retirement. And this whole thing about accessing it early, which is obviously bolstered by all this pensions freedom stuff, it's a bit like having a car and saying, my car is a really rubbish fridge. It's like... your pension isn't there to dip into. Your pension is there for your retirement. And there's so much now that helps first-time buyers. There's The Help to Buy scheme for 95% loan to value mortgages. There's the Help to Buy set. Help to Buy ISA. Can we make that term?
Yeah, why not? We like coining phrases here on Consuming Issues.
So, yeah, so that'll let you put money in safe tax-free for a deposit. The main issue, obviously, is house prices are pretty high. So maybe we just need to build more homes rather than let people get into their retirement savings.
Do you think we need to rein back then on this freedom with our pensions? Do we need to be a bit stricter, do you think?
I think the freedom that's being offered at the other end, the pensions freedom stuff, is really good. Giving people the power to do it. But my personal view about my pension is one of its greatest disadvantages is that I can't get at the money. And that is one of the best things about it, is I cannot get at that money until I'm 55. And it'll be older than 55 by the time I get there. But, you know, so it has to go towards my retirement. And I just worry that letting people take this money, you know, in and out of their pension, it just sort of creates problems down the line, because they're going to end up depleting. Not only are people not saving enough for their pension, they're then going to start taking money out of it and depleting it before they get there. And as Mark said, look, the fundamental problem here is basically that house prices are too high. And we keep coming up with creative ways to try and bridge this gap. But when you look at it, house prices versus wages are way too high. And the reason why they are way too high is basically because we had a massive housing boom and we've allowed it to continue with all these measures, low interest rates, free money for first-time buyers, which, let's face it, is what Help to Buy is. You know, the Help to Buy ISA, yeah, that's great. It's tax-free saving for a house. But now letting people dip into their pensions and, well, thinking about letting people dip into their pensions and so on. But the cold, hard reality of it is if you look at America, if you look at Spain, and if you look at Ireland, which also had massive housing booms, houses there are no longer as unaffordable as they were, and they're not bad value. Whereas if you look at them here, they're way too expensive. And the difference is that they had big property crashes, and we're just not willing to put ourselves through the pain that would then mean that houses are affordable again. Understandably, because most people who own one don't want its value to fall, and the people who hope to buy one certainly don't want to be told, well, do you know what, you're just going to have to take it on the chin and not be able to buy a house for 5 years, but in 5 years' time, trust me, you'll be better off. We've got a real problem, but I don't think bridging the gap with more and more creative ways to keep house prices high is a good idea.
I think that's where something like financial education is quite important, because if people were told from an early age how that 50 quid could help you save for the future and how, like, what that translates into. Because 50 quid a month is maybe 2 weeks of not buying a coffee at a coffee shop each day or something. If it was kind of related to real life and people saw they could just make savings by changing the way they spend their money, I think that could help.
Well, it all comes as a report from Lloyds found that the average home in a UK city is at its most unaffordable level since 2009. And also, the Nationwide Building Society says house prices are increasing less than half as fast as they were last summer, but that's still 5.1%. June, it was 12% year-on-year rate of climb. It's still pretty high.
You'd be a very lucky person if your wages were going up by 5% exactly. Every year, wouldn't you? And also, never forget that you say you're on £30,000 a year, which is a pretty good salary, right? And your wages go up by 5%. They're going to go up by £1,500. But if you've got a £200,000 home and that goes up by 5%, that's going to go up by, and now he's put himself on the spot to do the maths, that's going to go up by £10,000, right? So basically your wages have gone up by £1,500, the house you want to buy has gone up by £10,000, and both of them have gone up by the same amount. But actually we're in a scenario where wages are going up by about 2% and house prices are going up by 5%. It's a problem, but it's not a problem that people really like to talk about. And what would have been nice is if over the course of this Parliament, the one that's just about to finish, would be if the major political parties had really got to grip with this subject, because it's actually, it's a real problem for the UK economy. Way too much of people's money goes on mortgages and rent and this insane game of the property market, where you can't just make a decision of, oh, do I want to buy a bigger house? Can I afford to move? It's this sort of like going down the casino, red or black kind of thing. Ah, up, down, left, right. And we just haven't got to grips with it.
Another problem, and I like to end with the voice of your readers, Simon, and this is how to deal with cold callers. Don't hang up. Have fun while combating the scourge of phone pests. Tell us what this is all about.
Right, so anybody who spends a reasonable amount of time at home will get an awful lot of cold calls nowadays. And I don't necessarily think that those of us who spend most of their time in an office actually fully appreciate quite what level of cold calls people who spend a lot of the time at home get. Until someone gets hold of your office number and starts calling that, as I've got now. Keep getting these, we can write off your debts phone calls, which would be all right if they could actually write off my debts, but they can't. It's complete
rubbish.
Someone
in the office having a laugh, though.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Yes, Mark, behind me. I've got spam PPI messages on WhatsApp the other day. I'm like, how do they do that? So the suggestion was, basically, what you should do is just hang up on these people. And actually, our readers have come back and said, no, don't do that. Have a bit of fun with them. So we've got a suggestion of the old-fashioned keep a whistle by the phone and then blow it loudly as close to the earpiece as possible, which I thought people used to reserve for the old heavy breathing calls. I think this is a bit harsh
for some
poor bloke working in India. Play along and pretend you're hard of hearing. It does annoy them having to repeat themselves. I spend as long as possible just telling them about every conceivable ailment that pops into my head. And there's another one, wasting time. Je suis Clarkson says, I don't think this is a real Jeremy Clarkson. It'd be nice if it was, you know, because he's got a bit of time on his hands now. Do not hang up on them. Keep them on the line for as long as possible. Lead them down the garden path. Have some fun with them before telling them to get lost. Use up their time, and in doing so, you will be doing everyone a great big favour.
Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Mark Shoffman from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Thank you so much.
On digital radio and online, this is Share Radio.